Thank you, Pastor, and wonderful to be here with you in this lovely church. My first time here with you, and to spend this 115th anniversary with you, I'm honored that you would ask me. Anniversaries are important moments. They can be debilitating or encouraging. I'm having my 50th celebration this summer, but fortunately I can deflect it somewhat because I was born on my mother's 30th birthday. And so when she has her 80th, that's what we celebrate. And so I'm kind of in camouflage. I'm in the background of it, and I suppose it helps to assuage one's sense of getting older. But indeed, I'm not that nervous about getting 50. Some of you have already passed that, and you look okay, so I figure I'm going to be okay, too. One of our tasks as a national body, let me just give you a brief word about the Evangelical Fellowship. It's a national association of evangelical denominations, of which the Missionary Church has been a very early member when it was formed back in early 64. As a national association, our task is to be representative to the member denominations, to national government, to media, and with respect to those issues that concern the members of the association. We also have a responsibility to initiate action on various areas. We have a task force on the family, a task force on Canada's future, a task force on evangelism, Vision 2000, which was a catalyst for denominations to setting plans and strategies for evangelization. We have a social action commission whose responsibility is to help analyze national moral ethical issues. We publish a magazine, Faith Today, and other materials, and produce videos on educational videos on issues that concern us, as well as making representation on the national level. This here that you received in your bulletin this morning, let me just bring this to your attention. You're much aware of the difficulty in bringing about some kind of constitutional arrangement. Our involvement stems from the 2 years ago, actually, June 23rd, when Meech Lake died. When the accord became a discord, we established a task force on Canada's future, which has been working and presented to the government last December its paper with respect to an evangelical concern about our future. Out of that, in a very interesting way, came the opportunity for us to participate and indeed be the writer of the preamble, which is now part of the constitutional package which the premiers this Tuesday again will be discussing. Included in that as well as the Canada Clause. I met with 3 weeks ago with the Prime Minister on this preamble, and this week with Mr. Clark's department and Mr. Siegel, Chief of Staff for the Prime Minister's office. What we have been doing is encouraging the adoption of this or something similar to this, which is included on the back of your of this brochure. This is something that we wrote in early February. There were six of us under EFC that wrote this along with the Canada Clause, and we simply are encouraging the Prime Minister and the Premiers to accept this or something like it as a preamble giving a spiritual construct for the Constitution. Let me just read it for you. We are the people of Canada, drawn from the four winds of the earth, a privileged people, citizens of a sovereign state. Trustees of a vast northern land, we celebrate its beauty and grandeur. Aboriginal peoples, immigrants, French-speaking, English-speaking, Canadians all, we honor our roots and value our diversity. We affirm that our country is founded upon principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God, the dignity of each person, the importance of family, and the value of community. We recognize that we remain free only when freedom is founded on respect for moral and spiritual values and the rule of law, in the service of justice. We cherish this free and united country, its place within the family of nations, and accepting the responsibilities privileges bring, we pledge to strengthen this land as a home of peace, hope, and goodwill. It's been interesting to watch how this document, which I never thought would ever see the light of day, has been moving gradually along the rocky road of constitutional development. This week in the House, Mr. Clark rose in response to a question and in very guarded terms affirmed that indeed this is still considered as part of the process. What we are asking for Christians across the country to take and either use this or on your own letterhead. Your own letterhead is indeed better. But to take and write a private note to the Prime Minister and send it in this week. We still have a few days of getting them in. I would invite you to join with thousands of others in a very positive, proactive way of affirming something which we believe will have value to our culture. Now, you may ask, will anybody come to Christ because of this? Probably not. But what it does, it establishes a spiritual framework in which constitutional thought and debate indeed will occur. Down the road, as children learn about our country and consider the preamble, this might be the kind of preamble that they would memorize. When people come to our shores as immigrants to become citizens, in their understanding of what Canada is, this would be a means of helping them understand. It is not an imposition of Christian faith on a secular public. It's simply a development of a framework that is fair and, I believe, accurate to the ethos and the history of our country and what we believe this country might be under God. And so I would ask you to do that. But also pray this week. Well, the next 2 weeks are critical as they try to come to some kind of conclusion. And the decision will be made by internally on this issue by the political power brokers. But we believe that God indeed is supreme and sovereign, and we simply pray for His Spirit to be very much at work to bring about some kind of accord and a spiritual understanding of our nation. The psalmist said, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." And there is an accrual of blessing to a people, to a nation, when they recognize the creation principles of life. And so we would simply ask you and invite you to pray as you pray for the Y encounter and all the other elements of this church, may your mind also be open to the issues nationally, which I believe are so significant. As I thought about this event for you, I wondered, what could I speak to you about that might be important to the celebration and the anniversary that you hold today, but also might be forward-looking as God would speak to us about His heart and His world. And so I've chosen a text that's very, very well known. However, if I introduced to you saying that I'd like to talk to you about a worm of the story, you would say, excuse me. If I, however, said I'm going to talk to you about a whale of a story, you would know exactly what I was talking about. However, in my view, the story of Jonah is not about a whale, it's about a worm. And so I'd like you to turn with me, and if you have your Bible, hold it open to this text. Jonah is a little book that's tucked towards the end of the Old Testament. And so you don't have to look in the index to find out its page number, or fumble around embarrassed that you don't know exactly where it is. Let me just help you, because I know what it's like to be embarrassed. I fumble too. Go to the end of the Old Testament, which is just before the beginning of the New Testament. A little humor, folks, very little. And there's Malachi and Zechariah, and then there's Haggai and Zephaniah and Habakkuk. These are all little books. And Micah, and there's Jonah. Remember, with the Jewish people, you're dealing with a Semitic tribe. You're dealing with a people who do not have a text that they can carry around with them in some book or tablet form. The Old Testament was preserved and kept in the temple or the synagogues. Well, the temple at this point. And so people heard what was said and they remembered by story. But also they remembered by critical phrases within the story that would remind them of what was important. They were orally tuned. Now, this generation is visually tuned. And so when producers for commercials do a commercial, they are very, very careful in arranging things in such a way that there aren't any mistakes within the visual flow of the commercial or of the movie or of the story. Because our generation is so visually tuned, you can find defects. And indeed, the development of modern media is with respect to the visual education that we have experienced. We are very visually educated. Well, we are dealing with a culture that is orally educated. is very much aware of the verbal nuance or the slight the use of particular phrases or words that gives clues to what is being said. And Jonah is that kind of story. And so as we look at the story, keep that in mind, because there are some verbal clues that remind the hearer what's important. Well, Jonah was living at a time when Israel, the northern part, it was divided into Judah in the south and Israel in the north. That happened following Solomon. The northern part was harassed by Syria, and nothing has changed, has it? Today, Damascus in Syria is the thorn in the flesh, not only just to Israel itself, but also via Lebanon. It's the Syrian forces in the Bekaa Valley in the southern Lebanon that creates the greatest amount of harassment to Israel. The same was true during Jonah's day. The people of Israel were very much expecting the king, the Messiah, or in Greek, the Christ, the Christos, the one who would come and finally save Israel, both Israel and Judah, from the harassment of the enemies, and establish again the power of the throne of David. The David reign, the Davidic reign, always remained clear in the mind of the Jewish people, the high moment of Israeli culture and of the story of their nation. Indeed, when Christ came, it was expected that he again would sit on the throne of David. And so you have, at this point, an expectation of the throne of David being occupied by a powerful ruler. And they used an interesting phrase called the day of the Lord. And so the day of the Lord was a phrase that you find throughout the prophets at this time. They expected that moment, the day of the Lord, to come when all their problems will be solved. It's very much like a phrase that we hear today, isn't it? And we look around us at the problems that we're experiencing and the moral decline of our culture. What do we look forward to? A phrase that's very much like day of the Lord, but it's what? Return of the Lord. What does that mean to us? It means that in the difficulties of today's world, we know that at some moment Jesus Christ will come and will establish his eternal and final throne. That darkness and evil and sin will be eventually destroyed, and the kingdom of Christ will reign forever. There will be a new heaven and a new earth. We look forward to that return of the Lord. The Bible calls that the purifying hope. That which focuses our today's experience in relationship to what is ultimately true. The return of the Lord is a wonderful part of our theology, of our Christian life. We know that at some moment, given the suffering and the sorrow of today, Christ will return and sin will be defeated and we will live with Christ forever. That is a purifying hope. It's an expectation that we live with. And so it was true with the people of Jonah's day. The day of the Lord was that marvelous moment. However, there is also a downside to that expectation. What can it produce in our lives, the return of the Lord? It can produce a lackadaisical view of our responsibilities today. We say, problems are around us, surround us. And the coming of Christ is soon. The return of the Lord is soon. Therefore, why do anything about what's going on today? Best that we live our own protected, exclusive lives and simply wait for Christ to come. And so it can produce people who refuse to engage, refuse to be involved, and they protect themselves off on the side of the culture. And the same thing was happening at the time of Jonah. It's in that moment, in that kind of mindset, that the call of Yahweh, Jehovah, comes to Jonah. And the call is to go to Nineveh. Well, all you had to do was say the word Nineveh, and a Jewish person would recoil. Nineveh was that kind of place that a Jew would not find and would not be found at all. It was a vicious, violent city. It was known for prostitution, for witchcraft, and economic exploitation. It was all that the Jewish people detested. And so for those hearing the story that Jonah refused to go, there would be an applause. Of course, a good kosher Jewish boy would not be found dead in Nineveh. And so for him to say no to Jehovah about going to Nineveh would be exactly what you and I would expect as Jewish people. But Jonah does something interesting. What does he do? Well, he leaves. He runs away. Well, there's a very obvious question, isn't there? Why did he run away? Why didn't he just say no to God? If you keep in mind the geography of the Mideast, if you have the Mediterranean here and Israel down the side, Israel and Judah, Nineveh was up and northeast about 500 miles. Where did he go? He went over to Tarshish, which is at the bottom of Spain. It's 2,500 miles this way. It's 500 miles that way. Now, why did he do that? Why didn't he just say no? Why didn't he just do what you and I do, just say no? He ran away. Why did he run away? Well, for a very good reason. And indeed, I think it was one of the reasons that God called him to go to Nineveh. It's because Jonah, like the people of his day, had a very narrow view of God's world. And the whale, or the fish that was brought to, in a sense, rescue Jonah and rescue the others, was a vehicle that God employed to remind Jonah of the breadth of his world. You see, literally, the people of Israel believed that the God of Palestine was Yahweh. Palestine, therefore, was the place where God lived. God did not live outside of Palestine. And so if you run away from Palestine, what have you done? You've run away from God. Literally. Remember the Syrian general. He had leprosy. And he had working in his household a young Jewish lady. She had been taken captive in one of the raids into Israel. And she cared very much for her captain. And she heard that her captain had leprosy. She knew of a prophet back in Israel that could heal him. And so she connected the two, and he went down, Naaman went down. Remember, he dipped 7 times in the Jordan and was healed of his leprosy. But what did he do following that healing? He called his servants to fill the ox carts full of Israeli earth. For what reason? He would take that earth back to Syria, and he would build a shrine. Why would he build a shrine? Because with Israeli earth, he now had Israeli God. God literally would be there because God and the land were synonymous. Now, it's a wonderful thing to have a high view of your country and to have a high view that God cares about your country. But the danger is when you ever link God and country in that form of nationalism, what do? You implicate God in every action of the nation. You then can assume, as happened, the historians use the word manifest destiny about Americans. They have this linkage of God and country. The same kind of thing as the Boers did in South Africa, as the Israelis did in Palestine, there is an unholy linkage of God and land or God and country. And the danger is that then whatever you do becomes automatically blessed of God because God and land are one. And that's what happened with Jonah. He had this unholy linkage to the extent that if he left Israel, he had run away from God. He had this very narrow nationalistic view of God. Remember in the New Testament, there is a Roman leader, a soldier, a captain, who is hungering after spiritual reality. He hears about this Jesus movement, and so he sends some of his aides to find someone who could speak to him about Christ. And they seek out Peter. Well, Peter's having a rest in someone's home up on the garden up on top of the house. And while he is having this rest, he has a vision. And the vision is a sheet that's let out of heaven. And in the sheet are a variety of animals. Some animals which are legitimate according to the Levitical law, some which aren't. You know how popular a ham sandwich is at a Jewish feast. Well, there are some meats within the Jewish dietary habits, which are simply disallowed. But in this sheet, there are those kind of animals, those that are kosher, those that are non-kosher. And in the vision, the word of Yahweh, of Jehovah, to Peter is, Peter, rise and eat. And Peter says, no, I can't do that. I'm kosher. I'm a good Jewish boy. And the response of God to Peter is, Peter, what I have created, don't you dare call unclean. Now, what was he doing? He was rattling Peter's cage. He was upsetting Peter's very narrow view of God's world. And the reason was so that when Peter was eventually called down to meet those from the Roman captain's home who had come requesting that Peter go to Gentiles to minister Christ, Peter's narrow view of God's world had been broken down. Now Jonah very much had a very narrow commitment or a narrow understanding of God's world. And the story of the whale, in my view, is God's desire to break Jonah out of his narrow understanding of God's world. And he did that. And that's the first part of the story. Look at the last verse of the 17th verse of the first chapter. Here we have a verbal clue. Now, I read the American Standard, and it says, and the Lord appointed a great fish. If you read the NIV, it's the Lord provided, or the Lord created. But whatever phrase is used in the 17th verse, there is a parallel that's used in three other verses in the fourth chapter. We'll come to that in a moment. But you see here the activity of God in taking Jonah and doing something with Jonah. Why is he doing it? It's because he's concerned that Jonah understand the nature of his world. That's true for us. It's true for you and I today. How easy is it to get trapped by a narrow view of God's world? God's concerned about my family, my job, my children. And then we go out from there in concentric circles. And from time to time, maybe we go a little further. And other times we retreat and we have this very limited view of God's world. One of the tragedies of today as we look at the Rio Conference on the environment is that the very agenda that should be ours as Bible believers, as followers of Christ, has been robbed from us by what I call a social liberal left community. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof and all they that dwell therein. But what we have been happened as evangelicals, we've been trapped with a very, very narrow view of spirituality. And our only view of God's concern traditionally has been that all Christ is concerned about is getting us saved and ready for heaven. And that this world around doesn't matter. And in of course, what we have done is inadvertently we've affirmed the raping of our environment. Not in a direct way, but saying nothing, indeed, by the sin of omission, we've allowed the sin of commission to occur. And we have this very narrow view of what concerns God. And so today, God uses Cyrus and the pharaohs of Egypt, if you like, to deal with an agenda that's of God's concern, and that's the very nature of his creation of the planet. This is not Satan's abode. He is attempting to establish squatter rights in God's creation, but squatter rights are never legitimate rights. But what we do, if we simply allow Satan to dominate in a de facto sense, we allow Satan to own it. But it's still the Lord's, the entire creation. But what happens is, as Christians, we get a very narrow view of God's world. Because the narrowness of that view is the easiest way in which we can live. Is it not? It's much easier to live with a very, very narrow, self-contained of God's world. Because what does it do? It means that Nineveh doesn't matter to me. If God doesn't care about Nineveh, therefore I shouldn't be. And so the more that I can avoid Nineveh and maintain a very narrow view of God's world, the less problem I have. The whale came along in his life to remind Jonah of the nature of God's world. Jonah, my world is much bigger than Israel, or Judah. And wherever you
its 115th anniversary.
Be careful of the whale. But if you need to be concerned about the whale, let me remind you that we haven't even got to a word yet.
The second chapter is an interesting chapter. It's his prayer. Now, as I study that prayer, I'm not impressed, frankly. I really am not. You know, as you go through it, there's a certain smugness about Jonah. There's never an admission to God about his own narrowness. But it's a good way of getting out of the whale, and so he does make a modest confession. And so Jonah's released. Well, that's a nice way of putting it. The third chapter is when Jonah does what he's supposed to do. There's not much joy in his step as he marches the streets of Nineveh. It's almost in a grudging way he does what he's supposed to do. But I suppose, as a parent, I'd rather my child do it, even though he or she didn't like doing it, than not do it. And so Jonah, by behavior at least, does what he's supposed to do. But then we get to the fourth chapter. Well, let's begin at the 10th verse of the third chapter, setting up the context. When God saw their deeds, that they turned from their wicked ways, then God relented concerning the calamity which he had declared he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. In other words, he didn't destroy Nineveh. Verse chapter 4. But it greatly displeased Jonah, and he became angry. He prayed to the Lord and said, "Please, Lord, was this not what I said while I was still in my own country? Therefore, in order to forestall this, I fled to Tarshish. For I knew that thou art a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, and one who relents concerning calamity. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for death is better to me than life." And the Lord said, "Do you have good reason to be angry?" Then Jonah went out from the city and sat east of it. There he made a shelter for himself and sat under it in the shade until he could see what would happen in the city. Now, go back to the 17th verse of the first chapter. Pick up the phrase that's in your translation. Either provided, or appointed, or created, or whatever your phrase is. Now, here we come to the use of that phrase again, which to a hearer in that Mideast community, we're only listening, we can't read, we're only listening to the story, all of a sudden, we are reminded that now the story is coming into focus. As he appointed a great fish, or provided a great fish, verse 6, so the Lord God appointed a plant. And it grew up over Jonah to be a shade over his head to deliver him from his discomfort. And Jonah was extremely happy about the plant. But God appointed or provided a worm. When dawn came the next day, and it attacked the plant and it withered. Verse 8. And it came about when the sun came up that God appointed a scorching east wind. And the sun beat down on Jonah's head so that he became faint and begged with all his heart to die, saying, "Death is better to me than life." You can almost hear God saying, "Jonah, as he appointed a plant, I love you so much, I'm going to bless you. It's hot out here. I'm going to bless you." And then you can hear him saying, when he appointed the worm, "I love you so much, Jonah, I'm going to take away your blessing. That's what I'm going to do to you." And then when he appointed the scorching east wind, if you've ever been in L.A., and you've had those scorching east winds come off the desert, which indeed has provided that environmental condition which brings about those great fires, that blasting wind off the desert. That's what you're talking about. I can hear God saying when he appoints this wind, he says, "Jonah, I love you so much, I'm going to make you miserable." What's he doing? If the whale is a reminder of God's world, the worm is a reminder to Jonah of God's heart. Now, let's read on, because there's another clue here that's important. Verse 8. God said to Jonah, do you have good reason to be angry about the plant? Do you have any good reason to be angry about it? He said, you bet your bottom dollar I do. I've good reason to be angry even to death. The Lord said. Well, then the Lord said, but he probably said, too. He said, Jonah, you had compassion on the plant for which it didn't work. You didn't do anything about this plant. I've become a good gardener, or tried to become a gardener the last few years. I really enjoy it, and I have great fun with flowers and plants, and I put in a lot of bulbs this year. And after I had done all those bulbs, my wife said, did you put them in the right side up? And I said, you sure? Yes, I did. She said, how did you do it? So I described it to her. I'd put them in the wrong side up. Well, the ones I couldn't find, I think, are looking for the surface, and maybe the roots are, so maybe they'll come up by the 1st of August. I don't know. You had compassion on the plant for which you didn't work. You didn't even do any work with this, Jonah, in which you didn't cause to grow. You didn't give it any fertilizer. You didn't help it. You didn't nurture it. It came up overnight and perished overnight. Now remember, you're in the Mideast. You aren't living here. This last verse unfolds the whole book. What does it say? Jonah, shouldn't I have compassion on Nineveh, the great city in which there are 120 persons who don't know the difference between the right and left hand? We're in the Mideast. In the Mideast, you better know the difference between your left and your right hand. The right hand is used for eating without utensils. The left hand is used for bodily cleansing. No offense, but this is the Mideast and this is the Bible. I don't think I have to say anything further, do I? You see, if you don't know the difference, you can get very sick, because you'll simply pass through the digestive tract disease if you don't know the difference between the left and the right hand. What's God saying? Jonah, these people are morally stupid. They don't know the difference between the right and left hand. And I care about them. Jonah, you're prepared to write them off. But they are morally ignorant. And even though they're morally ignorant, I love them and I care for them, and I want them to know my truth as well. Jonah, I want you to understand the nature of my heart. And Jonah's devastated. We have no more but where he went from here. But he used the worm as a means of bringing Jonah to understand the breadth of God's heart. And if there's something that you and I need on moments of celebration when we're grateful for God and for what he has done in our lives, it's a moment in which he says to us, that's fine, that's all good. However, in this changing world now, I want you to understand about how much I care for others. My world is bigger than yours, and my heart encompasses much more. Some time ago, I was invited to do the journal with Barbara Frum on the issue of AIDS. They gathered about 300 people together, and then there were about 10 or 11 of us around a table invited to speak about the issues of AIDS. There was the head of the, in fact, I saw his picture this morning in the Sunday Star, who's head of AIDS research at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, and the health officer from San Francisco, and Margaret Somerville, head of ethics at McGill University, and I was there to ask the religious question. I was the token religiousite, I suppose. Well, when Barbara introduced me with the Evangelical Fellowship, the crowd booed me because of the word evangelical. Well, on a spur of the moment, I changed my approach, and I said, it seems to me that you have already judged me on what you think I'm going to say before I've spoken. Could it be that you're doing the same thing that you accuse us of? And there was a polite applause and a certain kind of carnal pleasure for me out of that one. But in the course of that evening, Something happened to me that I wasn't prepared for. One of the members around the table was a teacher from Vancouver, a homosexual who was dying of AIDS. His name was Al. As I looked across the table at Al, something happened. It was as if the Spirit of God made his eyes a mirror. And I looked not into Al's eyes, but I looked at a reflection of me. And what I saw was ugly. It was hatred, it was contempt, it was reaction. There was nothing of Jesus that I saw. And I was shocked. And in that moment, I knew I had been found out. I didn't know what to do. I was very, very disoriented. But we went through 4 hours of taping, because they were taping over 4 hours and then editing it into 3 hours for the journal, for 3 evenings for journal viewing. I didn't know what to do. But I knew God had found me out. And I knew I couldn't get out of there without some kind of resolve. I waited until the end. And after the cameras were being rolled away and the lights were being turned down, I walked around the table to where Al was talking to Barbara. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say, but I knew I'd been found out. And I waited until the two were finished talking. And Al looked at me, and it was almost as if there was fear in his eyes that I'd hit him over the head with my Bible. He knew that's what we as Christians do. And on impulse, I put my arms around him and I prayed for his healing. I didn't know what else to do. He stepped back, and you should have seen the look on his face. You should have seen the look on Barbara's face. He said, "Brian, I'm a Buddhist." I said, "Al, I don't care what you are. You're God's creation. And I'm here to tell you that I love you." I didn't feel that, but I've lived 29 years with the same woman. That's my wife, not my mother. And I've learned that what I say and what I feel is not always synonymous. You know that too, don't you? But I was there because the worm had caught the bush, had eaten the vine, and I was exposed. The Lord was saying, "Stiller, I don't care how you feel as a heterosexual male. I don't care what your views of sexuality are out of my word. You're here to understand the nature and the breadth and the encompassing nature of my heart. He is as much a creation of mine as your son Murray or your daughter or anyone else. He is mine by creation, and I love him. And I call you to love what I love." It was a Damascus road for me. Oh, my views on sexuality have not changed. I have that same very basic male heterosexual instinct. I have no understanding of that homosexual impulse. But God has taught me a tough lesson. I'm reminded that if God has to use the whale in my life, be careful. But if he has to use the worm, watch out. He wants us to know the nature of his world, what is his creation. But he also wants to know the nature of his heart. And may on this anniversary day, the people of this church community would astound the community around by our understanding of God's world and God's heart.